Thought I was going to get to do rules. I was excited. I made the mistake of telling my husband once that my first grade report card said Beth has excellent leadership potential, but she tends to be a bit bossy at times. He thought that was hilarious. I don't know why. My name's Beth Hartley. I'm an alcoholic. Because of God's grace, AA, and sponsorship, I've been sober since June 26, 1988. And it's such an honor to be here. I want to thank all who made it possible for us to come. This is just amazing up here. It's taken us a day to adjust. We live about 100 feet above sea level, so I mean, we are really breathless to be here. So We had a pretty uneventful flight yesterday. We just flew from Raleigh to Atlanta, changed planes, flew to Colorado Springs, drove up. It was beautiful. Our luggage had more of an adventure than we did. Our luggage has been to Minneapolis, Denver, Gunnison, Colorado Springs, and it joined us this afternoon. So we're way happier to be here now that we actually have clothes and everything. I never know where to start. I drank a lot. That's probably a good place to start. A lot. When he was reading from the doctor's opinion, I read that when I was new. And you know, when it says they're often able, friendly, intelligent people, normal in all respects, except when they drank, I thought, yeah, you know. And then the longer I'm sober, the more I realize that the parts that I identified with were the first paragraph where it says there's the psychopath who's always going on the wagon. And it's like, I don't really relate to the normal, able, intelligent one. I'm more up there in the psychopath category, but that's okay. It keeps me entertained. I don't know about you. Who's new here? Who's in like their first 90 days? Anybody brave enough to come here under 90 days? All right, how about first year? Who's in their first year? Wow, a bunch of old timers here. Not much I can tell you. Thank you. Well, I just want to tell you, if you're new and you are not happy to be here, that is absolutely fine. I was not happy to be here either. This is the last place I wanted to be. I tried everything else first. My dad joined AA when I was 7 years old. So I was going to open speaker meetings as a grade schooler. I was the kid in the corner coloring. I knew AA was full of old men that drank and coffee and smoked and ate donuts because I'd seen it myself. And, you know, I mean, they were all my dad's age. My God, they're in their 30s, you know. And he told me about the horrors of his drinking and the tragic lost dreams and all that. And I just, when I drank, I felt so bad for him that he had a hard time. There we are. Like, God, Dad, if you could have drank more like me, you could have hung in there longer, you know. But I probably because of that, I stayed away from alcohol a little longer. But so I didn't grow up with active alcoholism in the family. My dad stayed sober through my childhood. My mom, it was a marginal Al-Anon goer a little bit, but we didn't have the flying skillets and the excitement and the drama. She was a covered door slammer. That's about as intense as it got. I was an only child. We always lived next door to big families, so I would just adopt myself into their families. Because even as a kid, I did not do well by myself. If I was alone in a room, my favorite promise in the book is the one that says we can be alone at perfect peace and ease, because I couldn't. I never could. If I was alone in a room, I was in bad company. There were a chorus of voices in my head. None of them liked me. You'd think I could find one friendly voice up there, but no. You know, they told me things. You know, at 4 and 5 years old, they're telling me things like, you know, nobody really likes you, and they only play with you because their mothers make them, and everybody's still laughing about when you fell down playing hopscotch last year. And, you know, I mean, just on and on. I never knew what to say to people. I was always just obsessed with how does it look and how am I going to look, and I don't want to look bad. I passed through AA a couple of times before I got sober, and, you know, they would talk about being self-centered, and I just didn't get that. You know, I thought self-centered meant vain and selfish, and I was neither of those. Just ask me, you know. I'm the most loving, giving person I know. But I didn't know self-centered meant I will not try anything new in public because you might see me fail. I didn't know self-centered meant if I can't win, I don't want to play. If I'm not good at it by the third try, I'm not doing it. I know you're talking about me if I walk into a room and two of you way back there lean your heads together and laugh. I felt like my life was a spectator sport and I was the one watching it. There was just like a little camera up in my head that was always surveying, watching all of you watch me, you know, and I never really talked to you. It would appear like it was conversation, but really you'd start your sentence and I'm up here finishing it and selecting from my six different answers. And, you know, it was just very busy in my head. I was tired a lot. And I read a lot as a kid. That was probably my first escape. I could just tune out in a book. And I think all the early reading is why school came so easily to me, because if I'd had to work at it, I would not have been the student that I was, because I just, work is work, you know? I mean, Chuck says I'm a type AL personality. And for those of you who don't know what that is, he said, because I had to ask, I didn't know either. And he said, well, you are most definitely a type A personality, but you're lazy enough that you're not annoying. And I can work with that, you know? And I am. I just never, you know, my kids were 4 and 6 when I got sober. And my daughter was 4, and my son was 6. And our daughter was blonde hair, blue eye, gleam in her eye, pathological liar. You know, I mean, we used to tell people, you might be saving for college, we're saving for treatment. And we just knew it was coming, you know. And when she was 11 years old, she wanted to be on a swim team. A lot of her friends swam, so we took her to try out for the team. And the coach said, well, you could be on the team, but, you know, she hadn't had much experience in the water. So he said, you could be on the team, but I'd like you to practice down in age group, you know, and until you catch up. So this man at 11 years old, he wants her to swim with the 9-year-old. If that had been me, that would not have been okay. I mean, how's that going to look? You know, I was having a hard time being the mother of the 11-year-old who's swimming with the 9-year-old, because, you know, how am I going to look? And what's wrong with your kid, you know? And she's fine with it. She practices with the 9-year-olds, you know? She goes to her first swim meet, and these are USS teams where there's 20 teams, and they run all the heats and just post the results. And her very first race ever, she was 70th out of 72, and she went back the next day. I would have been trying to get my parents to relocate. And we told her, okay, Sarah, now, you know, you didn't win. But you have a baseline time now. So in your next race, even if you don't win that race, if you beat your time, it's a successful race. Now, the whole time I'm telling her this, I'm thinking, oh, yeah, right. You know, I mean, get the ribbon for God's sakes, you know, but I know, you know, you kind of intuitively know. So my parents told me the same thing. When I swam, it's in the parent self-esteem handbook, tell your kid this crap. And, you know, I never believed it when they told me. I knew you were supposed to get the ribbon, but, she beat her time and she was happy. The rest of the story is that 2 years later, she was a state AA swimmer. She swam all over the Midwest for years. And I would have missed every bit of that the day they told me to practice with the 9-year-olds. And at 11 years old, she had never had a drink, and neither had I. And that was a real eye-opener for me, because I was 7 years sober when all that started to happen. And I realized that she and I just react completely differently to life. And I've come to believe that she doesn't really even react to life. She just kind of lives life, you know. I mean, I'm a ping pong ball. I'll go here till I hit something, and then I'll go this way. She just kind of, you know, so now we don't know what to do with her. I mean, we had her whole AA future mapped out, you know. Now she's doing this crap, you know. It's like, so we started to watch her with interest. I mean, what are you going to do, you know? Chuck and I are conferring between us, you know, like, what do you think this is normal? I mean, like, we would, who knows what that looks like in our house, you know. But she just kind of went on like that, you know. I mean, she was headed for us, and then she just took this turn, and she got a summer job and saved money, and she had the same friends in 12th grade when she graduated that she had in kindergarten. One school. She went to one school the whole time. My first geographic cure was in 6th grade. I had to transfer schools. I hated everybody at the school I was at, you know. And she just was this easygoing, well, They opened a Starbucks the year she was a junior in high school. They opened a Starbucks in our town. So she came home the first day it was open. Very exciting, you know. You went to Starbucks. Who'd you go with? And she told me, Lindsay, Katie, and Jennifer. And I just went, Jennifer, you went with her? And she just looked up at me and said, for God's sakes, Mom, that was sixth grade. Could you let it go? I still hate that girl. So we every now and then would tell her, congratulations, you know, there's supposed to be one mature person in the house, and we're pretty sure it's you. But, she knew before she was out of high school what she wanted to do. She joined the military on the delayed entry program after her junior year. After her senior year, she swore in like she was supposed to, and she's actually in Afghanistan right now and is in her 10th year in the Army. So, you know, I mean... And she still talks to us. But so I guess what I'm saying is that I've come, you know, the bottle says drinking's a symptom. And when I was new, I read that and I thought, yeah, whatever. But really drinking was, you know, seemed to cause most of my problems. But the longer I'm sober, the more it's revealed to me that my thinking was off long before I ever picked up a drink. I couldn't sit in a room alone. I never knew how to talk to people. I do not know what to say. After, hi, my name's Beth. Conversation escapes me. Still, I'm not real good at it. If I'm in a new meeting, I just go greet. Because you can appear to be talking to a lot of people, but you don't really have to talk to anybody. And if you're not good with people, be a greeter. It's perfect. And, everybody in my head's always arguing. And I would just, so if I would meet you, I'd say, hi, my name's Beth. And she might say, hi, my name. Well, she would go, hello, my name's Ellen. And then I would be like. And then everybody in my head is arguing. Say something. You're just staring at her. She's staring at you. She's waiting for you to talk. What are you going to say? I don't know. You know, and it's, they're all arguing. I'm paralyzed. We have to go. And. Those problems disappeared when I took a drink. You know, I didn't drink until I was 15 years old. I didn't get falling down drunk the first time I drank. Some of my friends were experimenting. They were falling down, throwing up, looking bad. I don't like to look bad, so I just kind of got an experimental buzz on, and it was enough. I wouldn't have told you I was uptight until I relaxed, you know. But I just was like, oh, and suddenly things just weren't so urgent. And I took my friend out to get her drunk with me so I'd have somebody to drink with. And our friendship didn't make it another year because we drank different from the start, you know. And eventually anything that got between me and a drink had to go. I did my share of outside issues and my favorite drug of choice was yours. And I'm a child of the 70s. They were out. If you got them, I'll do them, by golly. And eventually the drugs started to interfere with my drinking. And so my daughter put that on Facebook a couple weeks ago. Quote from Mom, yes, I quit doing drugs. It interfered with my drinking. So. We're a constant source of entertainment to those two. So... But I just, you know, from the day I drank, if I could have gotten it, the only thing that kept me from being a daily drinker was lack of access. You know, from the beginning, I could drink a lot. I loved to drink. My day just went better with a drink. I mean, in high school, morning drinking really makes sense because you have to sober up before school's over and you go home. And I just loved to drink. I just loved it. I still get a little teary about it sometimes. I just, you know, it didn't really matter what. Scotch is about the only thing that didn't agree with me. The rest of it, it's on. And I just, you know, I drank with the big boys because I could. I could keep up with the big guys. That's who I drank with. You know, the girls in high school, when they were drinking, they're giggling and falling down and throwing up. Or everybody likes the same boy, and it's very complicated. And then later, it's more complicated because now it's like, oh, that was your husband. I'm so sorry. And, you know, it's just easier to drink with the guys. And, you know, I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they said, hang with the women. And I was just horrified. I just thought... I didn't even drink with women, and you want me to hang out with them sober, you know? Oh, my God. So I was off and running. The only reason I got through high school, I think, is because I didn't drink till the end of my freshman year. And I immediately, you know, they used to have an Al-Anon questionnaire. I don't know if they still do on, is your kid doing this? And I was doing all, you know, change of friends, change of attitude, change of appearance. Every bit of it, I was doing it all. Why I slid through, who knows? You know, I get my parents were, I think my dad was getting ready to drink. And for whatever reason, I just kind of skated through. And I grew up in a little town in Oxford, Ohio, and that was one of my first resentments because I did not want to be from Ohio. You know, I was born in California. I was supposed to be a California girl. And I, you know, watch. I could have made it. But apparently due to my dad's drinking, we relocated to Oxford, Ohio when I was 2.5 years old. I remember the first day of first grade looking at a map of the United States, seeing the oceans, Texas, California, Florida, all these places that I heard it was warm all the time, you know? And then there's Ohio. And I'm 6 years old looking at a map thinking you could look at a map and tell that nothing is happening in Ohio. You know? And I know now, because it's like, where does that come from at six, you know? But it came from the same place as, I wish my mom didn't laugh so loud. I wish we had a better car. You know, I was already by 6 years old looking for outside things to make the inside feel better. Because I was already restless, irritable, and discontent at 6 years old. So now I'm drinking in high school and it's fabulous. And I'm, you know, rapidly discarding, because up until I drank, I was very busy, because I can't sit still, because it's too unfriendly when I'm alone. So I was a cheerleading, and pep club, and yearbook staff, and student council, and honor society, and you name it, because I had great grades, like I said, and I'm a test taker, too, you know, I'm one of those people that, if you're a test taker, you know who you are, you know, it doesn't require a lot of work, we just look at it, spit it back on the test, and can't tell you 2 days later what we read. You can ace treatment if you're a test taker. It doesn't work so well in day-to-day AA living. But but I have no idea where I was going with that one. Oh, school, busy, busy, busy. So when I drank, all of a sudden I didn't need to be busy anymore. And all of that stuff started to go away. Some of it got taken away. They don't like their cheerleaders skipping school to go to Green Beer Day. You know, some of it I gave away. Who cares? I don't care about that anyway. And some of it slid away unnoticed. And one of the things that's happened since I got sober is that I've gotten back whole pieces of my life that I didn't really even know were missing until they came back. Because alcoholism is cunning, and it's subtle, and it's sneaky. And when Chuck got his first degree, we got UC. He went to University of Cincinnati. And they gave everybody who graduated a free ticket to the first football game of the fall. And we figured out after we got there, it's because UC was on quarters and the students didn't come till the end of September and they wanted to fill the stands. But we didn't care. We liked football and we went to the game. And I grew up in a college town. You know, Miami University was in Oxford. And I was going to college sports as a kid. And I just, you know, I went from loving sports to sitting in the bar talking about going to the game. And when we were at that football game and the cheerleaders were warming up and the band was warming up and the stands were filling up, you could smell the hot dogs. And I just realized I had tears running down my face because here was a whole piece of my life back that I hadn't even known was gone until I got it back. And that's happened over and over and over. And I'd wanted out of Ohio ever since I found out it was warm other places year-round. I've never been much of a winter person. You'll not see me visiting somewhere up north on purpose after... I don't know, September maybe, but I've just never been a cold weather person, and so I started trying to get my parents to move south, and they wouldn't, and so I finally, my big mystery lately has been I graduated high school, and I went off to college, because I live in a college town, that's what you do, and it hit me about 3 years ago, as bad as I hated the Midwest, why did I go from Ohio all the way to Indiana to go to college? I don't know. You know, it's the ping pong ball thing, and... So I flunked out of college because apparently it helps if you go to class, but I couldn't. Now, I wasn't drinking in college because I planted myself square in the middle of a 21 state, so I didn't really have access to alcohol. And I don't know how to talk to people if I'm not drinking. So I couldn't go to class and sit by you because I might have to talk to you. And, you know, it just was hard. And so I flunked out of school, having gone in with, you know, ACTs and SATs in the high 90s percentile. Another bright future pulled down. And I went back to Ohio, got a job in a bank because I figured that was a respectable thing to do. They worked Monday morning. That was over in a hurry. And and I had a friend who had a friend in Florida, and he said, we should go to Florida. And I said, we should. I had wanted to run away from home since I was 12 years old. So I packed my stuff, snuck out of the house, took off to Florida all the way through Kentucky. I am watching the rearview mirror for the sheriff that's going to make me go home. I get to Florida. I get a job in a convenience store immediately. I'd worked in one in Ohio. Now, I moved to Bonita Springs in 1978. It was so transient down there. If you went to work 3 days in a row, you were management material. So by the time I called my mom, I said, but I'm assistant manager at this store, don't worry. And then she asked me this stupid question. She goes, well, why didn't you just tell us you were moving? And I thought, I ran away from home. That would kind of be defeating the purpose, you know? And she said, you know, Beth, you're 19, you could have just left. And I thought, what? I mean, I had no idea. You know, it was so foreign to me. It never occurred to me to just move. So I'm like 19-year-old runaway now in Florida. We had a friend in Cincinnati who said they really should have put a sign at the state line of Florida, Arizona, and California that says, this state doesn't work either. And a lot of us just, if you saw somebody drive up, read the sign, slump, and turn around and leave, that's the alcoholic. And so now I'm in Florida, and of course, by the end of 8 months, there's no checks on my drinking now, and it's 80 degrees at 7 o'clock in the morning, so I can drink early. And by the end of 8 months, I was out of places to work. It was a small, 3 traffic lights, a dog track, 2 Shop-A-Go's, little town. And so I'm out of places to work. I'm out of people to date because I did most of my dating at Last Call, and there was only 3 bars in town. And like you didn't. I know. You know. They're still there on Sunday. It's a relationship. And, so by the end of 1978, it's looking like I'm going to have to move back to Ohio because I can't take care of myself down there. There's nowhere to work. And as luck would have it, this guy moved to town from California, and he had a house and a car and a job, everything I was looking for in a man. And he had a Harley, and he was 6'2 with tattoos. It just, God, is life good or what, you know? So we started, and it really, I used to say it was one of those relationships that there never should have been a second date, but there wasn't. So, yeah, Last Call, 5 years later, we're still there. And it was just one of those one-night stands that just dragged on and on and on and on and on. We ended up getting married, and... because there were these 2 rules I lived by, and one of them was never, ever, 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 ever admit that you've made a mistake. So hence the 5-year marriage. And because I wasn't going to, like, wasn't going to be my fault we broke up, you know. And the other rule I lived by was that it wasn't all right not to know. You know, it is just not okay to not know what's going on. I was doing fake it till you make it long before I got here. And if I don't know or if I can't figure it out, then I just don't care. You know, that's stupid anyway. So now we're married in Florida. We have our son, and then we moved to the Keys. Went down on Tuesday, liked it, came back, moved on Friday. $400, 6-month-old baby. Hey, Mom, moved to the Keys, but don't worry, I'm assistant manager at this restaurant. You know, and she asked me a lot often. She would say, how can you do things this stupid and land on your feet? It really made her crazy. She is that like an Al-Anon thing? Yeah. It just made her nuts, you know. And I was like that guy in the cartoons that just kind of wanders down the street and the pianos and the safes are crashing behind them, you know. Just that was me. I just skated and skated. Every now and then I'd get clipped, but I just never got crushed like I should have. The only time I ever got suspended from school ever for drinking, it snowed that night and there was no school the next day. So my record's clear. I don't know about yours, you know. And I just counted on that. But now we're in the Keys, and oh my God, when Bill Wilson says I had arrived, I'm in an oceanfront resort, full run of the place. I started in the restaurant, but I became their night auditor pretty quickly. I didn't even know what a night auditor did, but I applied, and I got to bring the baby to work. There were seven bars and three restaurants on this property, and my job was to go ring out the register at every bar. They gave me the keys to all seven of those bars, and they doubled my pay. I had arrived. And I would go close out the quarter deck and have a drink with them, and close out the tiki bar and have a drink with them. And I mean, this place was a wonderful place to work. Some of you probably know where I'm talking about. And all the security guards were bikers. It just was great. And we would, you know, the restaurant was on the sixth floor. We'd just lock the elevator and sit up there and drink and do outside issues off the bar. And it, God, it was great. And so now life is at, like, full bore. You know, we are traveling now. And we had started a little part-time kind of home-based business while we were in the Keys. It's expensive to live down there, you know, and there was a lot of importing and exporting going on down there. So we had a little distributorship, nothing big, just a couple $100 a week and some free product. And so, of course, we finally eventually got arrested for that. And I remember telling the probation officer that it really just was a part-time job. You know, you know how people get that funny look on their face when you tell them what you're really thinking? And she just looks at me like, part-time job. You know, down here we call that sale of a controlled substance. And that was trouble I got in. I thought I might not get out of, but even that I skated out with minimal damage. And by now I went out of my marriage, but I can't leave because if I leave, it's my fault. So I just drink till he can't stand it, and he says, get out. And he only had to say it once because I wanted out, but it had to be his fault. And I ended up back in Ohio on probation for this little part-time job of mine. And I thought, okay, fine, maybe I should go to AA. Now, I'd gone to a couple meetings while I lived in the Keys because I got fired from this great job, among other things. Well, before that whole part-time job thing came up, they had fired me one other time because I'd gone at 5 for happy hour and I was still there at 11 when I was supposed to clock in. So they fired me, and I intuitively knew I wasn't going to find a job like that anywhere else. So I went to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1983 in Key Largo. I went to the Tuesday night Key Largo group of Alcoholics Anonymous. They were very nice. They were very old. You know, they were all, it's just a little discussion group where they all sat in a circle and related to each other, and I just, and I mean, the meeting was over, and they invited me to Perkins, and I'm thinking, you know, okay, let me see, I'm 24 years old, I have a Harley Davidson parked down the street, it is 9:30 at night, and I've just been invited to Perkins. My life is over. So I, you know, skipped the Perkins thing, but I went and talked to my boss, told him I knew I had a problem, went to AA, blah, blah, blah. Got my job back after one AA meeting. AA works, it really does. And went to the Friday night meeting, told him I got my job back, and that was the end of my AA career in the Keys. But I did call my dad and tell him that I had been to a meeting. Because, you know, with a sober parent, you don't really put the word alcoholic in the same sentence with your name. You know, because I've heard speakers who said they would sit in the bar and go, oh, I'm alcoholic, who cares? Well, when you have a sober parent, you can't do that. Because you just can't put it out there in the universe too close where they might connect up. Because I knew if I ever wondered if I was an alcoholic out loud, that a big book was going to drop out of the sky, and the bartender would probably hand me a meeting schedule, and the AA police would come drag me to a meeting. So I never wondered, but when I went to that Key Largo meeting, it's the first time I said out loud that I was an alcoholic. So I called my dad and told him, and within a week I got a box from him. I had a big book, 12 and 12, each day a new beginning, one day at a time, 24 hours a day, a tape of his talk, a few pamphlets. They didn't really do t-shirts back then, so I didn't get a t-shirt or anything. But, you know, it was, I don't know how long he'd been throwing that stuff in the box, but one meeting and it was in the mail. And so now I go back to Ohio and I'm thinking maybe I'll go to AA, but I really thought if I just quit drinking with bikers that my life would calm down, you know. And so I tried drinking in my mom's neighborhood. Her whole neighborhood stepped off the pages of an L.L. Bean catalog, and it didn't go any better there than it did anywhere else. So, and I got to tell you, 1984 in Cincinnati, Young People's was on fire up there. They had just had Iggy Pop in town in 83. And they had a Monday night Young People's group that was 200 strong. And they had a Friday night live meeting that was 150. And it was enthusiastic, active, sponsored, structured Alcoholics Anonymous. But when I walk into a big room full of people, it separates into two groups, all of you and me. And you all knew each other, and you're all talking and laughing. And I don't know what to say after my name's Beth here any more than I do anywhere else. I can go to a bar with $5 alone and know what I need to know. I know who can drink as long as me, who shoots pool as well as me, and who knows where the party is later. You know, I really would rather go to the bar by myself because, well, you know, you never know when true love's going to strike and you got to be ready to go. And so I just, you know, AA wasn't really working. I know I gave it a good 2 weeks. I'm just sure of it. But it wasn't really working for me. So I was off on my merry way. And within a year, my children had been removed from my custody. They were in bed. I had nothing to drink. There was a bar down at the corner. And I walked down to the corner bar. And my son was 3. He woke up, couldn't find me, walked out onto the front porch. It was down a step. He couldn't, thank God, that's all the farther he went, you know, but he couldn't reach the doorknob to get back in. So he stood on the porch and cried. And the neighbors called the police. And the police called, it didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out where I was. My car was parked right in front. There's a bar down there. They called the bar to see if perhaps I was there and did I maybe want to come home. And so, you know, my mom got that call that no mom wants to get at 2 o'clock in the morning. Come get your grandchildren, your daughter's under arrest, you know, and her life got turned upside down. So all of a sudden at 51 years old, she's a single mother of a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old. And I'm saying, butt out and leave me alone. This is none of your business. I'm not hurting you. Because that was my anthem, you know, that was my anthem. And she ended up with my kids for a long time because I, well, it was suggested to me that I go to treatment and that maybe I wouldn't go to jail for 6 months. So I did. You know, that sounded like a good plan to me. And when I got to treatment, of course, I already have a tape of my dad's talk if you'd like to listen to it. I already have my own big book. I've underlined a few things if you'd like to see what I think are the pertinent points. You know, I mean, I'm already a rock star in treatment, and I can ace treatment. I'm good at treatment, you know, and I was the one that they got to come talk to other women who didn't want to leave their children. How I, oh yeah, God's cosmic joke on me, 6 weeks long treatment, all women. So now I'm in this all women's treatment center because it was the one that would take my no insurance. And I was the one that they would get to talk to women who didn't want to leave their children for 6 weeks. And I could tell them all the right things about better 6 weeks now than forever later, because if we're not sober, we can't be parents. But I had a problem developing while I was in there. And the big book addresses it. It says we have a double life, the one we know is true and the one we want the world to see. And what I was realizing while I was in there was that I didn't really want my children back. That single parent thing was impossible, you know. And I knew they were better off at my mom's house. At her house, they got read to. She read them a story every night before they went to bed. They slept every night in clean pajamas on clean sheets. They got age-appropriate food at mealtime. They got to daycare in clean clothes. I couldn't do any of that, and I hated her for doing it. I mean, don't think for a minute that I was grateful, because alcoholism doesn't allow things like gratitude. You know, the kind of daughter I am with untreated alcoholism, my mom ended up with my kids, well, for many years, but 3 years before I even got sober. And they would come over an occasional weekend, and on Sunday afternoon, I would talk to them about the fact that I was going to get an apartment soon so we could live together. And I knew it was baloney, you know, but I also knew that they would go home excited and tell Grandma, and she would have to be the bad guy and talk them down. Because that's what I do when you're in my way. I will mow you down if you're between me and a drink. And how do you make amends for that? Well, I'm saying I'm not hurting anybody, but out, leave me alone. So my kids were with my mom for years, you know, and I, one of the things that happened while I was in treatment is I'm the only child of divorced parents, and my dad died suddenly, which kind of wrecked my plans to go be sober with him, and I got the insurance money. So I got to drink the way I wanted to drink for the next 2.5 years. And by the end of 87, I was tired. The checkbook was tired. Everybody was tired. And I had a night where I just thought, I can't live like this anymore. I never tried to kill myself because I knew I would live. You know, I just knew on some level I would live, probably be maimed and look bad. And so I never attempted suicide, but if I had just dropped dead, it would have been fine with me. And one night I just said, I can't live like this anymore. God, you have to help me. You know, one of those earnest prayers. And I remember, so by now I'm living in a friend's attic. I used to say I'd moved into an attic apartment, and I realized a few years ago I didn't. It was an attic. won an apartment till I got there. And I moved in August, and at the end of the year, I hadn't unpacked yet. There was just a path to the couch and the TV and the bed. And that night I said that prayer, I remembered that big book that my dad had sent me. And I pulled it out, and I opened it up where I always open, page one, Bill's story, because that's where you start, is page one. You know, the Roman numerals are just for people who want to show off in treatment. That was my theory. You know, all the other times I had read, because, you know, you go to treatment, and they tell you the directions for living are in here, and you open it up, and it says, war fever ran high in a New England town. It's like, oh, yeah, this is helpful, you know. I can't wait to see what happens next. But that night I read Bill's story, and for the first time ever I identified with Bill Wilson and how he felt and how he thought. And, of course, what I know now is that when that book came out, there weren't meetings on every corner. And they put one per Bill's story is nothing more than what I'm doing here, one person's story of what he was like, what happened, what he was like now. And they put it in the front of the book so that maybe somebody like me would read it and identify and keep reading. And I read Bill's story that night, and I identified, and I slept with that book like it was a teddy bear. And when I woke up the next morning, I just felt better, you know, and I slept that night. Now, I didn't stay sober, because you know what I did that next day to stay sober? Nothing. Didn't read another page, didn't say another prayer, didn't go to a meeting, didn't call anybody, none of that. And sometime that day, the next, or the next, everybody in my head convened, decided we were probably going to drink anyway, let's get it over with. But the thing is, looking back, I can tell you that I believe God had removed the obsession to drink that day. And there are a couple other times in my life where he removed the obsession to drink. But if I don't do my part to stay surrendered, that obsession will not stay gone. You know, if I don't treat that gift like a gift when it happens, there's a guy in California that says, if you think God will do everything for you, lock yourself in a closet. When you get hungry, pray for a hot dog, you know? And so while the obsession was lifted right then, I didn't do a thing to stay surrendered, you know, which I have found is kind of the key to sticking around here. We are great at surrendering when the heat's on. But staying surrendered is a little harder, because I don't know about you, but when I start feeling back better, the first thing I get back is my opinion. So anyway, I did drink after that on and off, but it really was very sparse. And in June of 1988, I suddenly realized that I'd been gone from Florida for 4 years, and I thought, I bet everybody down there is going, God, I wish Beth would come back. And so I ran away from home again for the second time at age 29. I had a, because nobody was talking to me in Ohio by then, and I had an emergency credit card at my mother's, and going to Florida would seem like an emergency that day. So now I'm in Florida, and of course there's no homecoming parade down there, and by the end of a week the credit card's tired, I'm tired. And June 26, 1988, I was in the Fort Myers, Florida airport, and I didn't have a dollar. I didn't have enough. If I'd had enough for one drink, I could have got two. And then I could have come up with a plan, you know? But I didn't have enough for one, and I couldn't bear the thought of being asked to leave the airport bar, because we don't want your kind here, so I just didn't even go in. And I thought about finding some, you know, feeble-looking little old lady and stealing her purse and maybe getting a few dollars, but I was so hungover, and I just knew that I would pick on the little old lady that was still doing aerobics twice a week, and she'd run me down and take her purse back. I'd look oh so bad, and So I did what we do. I called Mommy and told her where I was and what I had done. And she said, call me later, and hung up. That wasn't looking good. And then she called her Al-Anon friends. Thank God. Thank God she did. And when I called her back, she said, I booked you a ticket, but I want you to know that I'm not really flying you home. I'm just flying the children's mother home, and it's because we're afraid we'll never see you again if we don't. And I got on the plane. Didn't have enough money for a drink on the plane either. Didn't have a clue that was going to be my sobriety date. I got off the plane, she picked me up at the airport, and she drove me straight to the county detox. I was not amused, I was ready to go home. But she had talked to her Al-Anon friends, and she took me to county detox and said what I know now was one of the hardest things she's ever said, which is go in or don't, but you can't come home with me, I've done everything for you that I can do. You have to do this yourself. And it didn't occur to me again until years later, the position I put her in. I'm the only child. And that county detox was in Over the Rhine in Cincinnati, which is, at the time, was on national news frequently for violence. It just was a horrible section of town. And when she left, she really didn't know if she'd ever see me again, because I could have turned around and walked off into the night and never been seen again. But she did what she had to do. And the next morning, I woke up in detox, and I was kind of mulling over my options, such that they were. And, my car was impounded. I had charges pending. I didn't know what they were. But, when the fog started to lift, I was like, oh, yeah, that might have prompted that trip to Florida, too, was the car getting towed and pending charges that I was pretty sure had to do with the car being towed. And I wasn't welcome in my attic. And none of that was really new. But what was different on this day was that I didn't have a plan about what to do about any of it. I just, everything I could come up with, there was nobody left to borrow money from, nobody left to go live with. I had no friendly direction left. And I'm so glad that I was out of plans, because, anytime I got a plan, I'm not done. And all the times before when I passed through, I always kind of had a plan how I could do AA my way. I'll do it your way kind of, but. And I just didn't have any ideas. And what I realized was I was 29 and a half years old laying in that detox bed, and I never expected to live to be 30. I thought I'd be dead when I was 30. I had no plans for being over 30, because why if you're not going to be around? And I suddenly realized I wasn't going to die, and that scared me. It was like a voice just said, people like you don't die, Beth. And I just went, oh, no. Because, I had mixed drugs and alcohol since I was 15 years old. I drove drunk. I rode motorcycles drunk. I drank with very large people in black leather that carried weapons. I bartended places where people shot at each other. I just should have been dead over and over. I know I look like such a suburban housewife now, but, I just should have been dead over and over and over and over and over, and I wasn't. And I realized that day I wasn't going to die, and that scared me. I had that. There, Bill C. from Greensboro, North Carolina, calls grace that moment when we see things exactly as they are. And I knew in that moment, no matter how bad it was, it could get worse. And that it could get, there were levels of worse that I couldn't even imagine. One of the handy things I've learned since I moved to North Carolina is how to boil a frog. I know, never know what you're going to need to know. I haven't actually done it, but in case you need to know. If you throw a frog into hot water, he will jump out. Seems like the smart way to go. If you put him in cold water and turn up the heat a little, he adjusts to the heat. And if you turn up the heat a little more, he adjusts to the heat. Turn up a little more and he adjusts. And all of a sudden he's dead in boiling water and he never knows what hit him. And isn't that alcoholism? Isn't that what we do here? Well, it starts to get bad and we just adjust. I heard somebody say once, bottom is when you can't lower your... what is it? You can't lower your standards fast enough to keep up with your behavior. But, it gets worse and we adjust and it gets worse and we adjust and it gets worse. And every now and then we rally a little, never to where we started, but we rally. And it gets bad again and might be getting desperate like AA or something. And then wow, that was a close one, That's just what happens, and we adjust all the way down to the bottom. And so I just had this passing thought in detox that, whatever those AA people were doing seems to be working for them. And clearly what you were doing is not working for you. Maybe you ought to try it their way. And I had no idea that would be the surrender that stuck. And I got out of detox. I made arrangements to go. I got out of detox on Friday, a 4th of July weekend. Nothing was happening until Tuesday. I made arrangements to go into a hotel for women. That should have been a sign of surrender there. But I couldn't get in there till Tuesday. I couldn't get my car till Tuesday. I couldn't do anything till Tuesday. And I knew if I went where I lived, I would drink. I knew that. And so I scraped up a little bit of money, and I got a very, and I mean very, cheap hotel room that was right on the bus line. And that's where I spent 4th of July weekend. And I would just walk out and get on the bus, and I just thank God there was no transfers involved, or it would have been too much. But I just had to walk out of the hotel, get on the bus, ride it down Reading Road, and then walk a block to the AA clubhouse. And that's what I did. And the very first night I walked in, the girl who was speaking, I had met 4 years before when I was passing through, and there she was 4 years sober. And she told a room full of people that alcoholism, not drinking, but alcoholism, had taken her to the place where she didn't want to work. And she didn't want to take care of her daughter. She just wanted to drink. And I never heard anybody say they didn't want to care for their child. That was my biggest secret. That was the one I would take to the grave. And here she told a room full of people. So I got her number after the meeting. And then I stayed for the midnight meeting. And there was laughter at that meeting. And the next day I sat, and it took me forever to call her, but I called her. You know, because somebody in my head said, you know, you didn't call people before when you drank. So it took half an hour, but I finally called her, and I just said, this is Beth. I got your number last night. I don't have a clue what to tell you. I'm just practicing using the phone. And she just laughed and said, that's what I had to do. And that's what I tell new people to do. Just call me and tell me your problem. We're not going to have deep philosophical conversations when you're 4 days sober, you know? I mean, I'm 23 years sober now. I still don't have deep philosophical conversations. So you'd be alone if you were trying to have one. But sad but true. I read the cartoons first to this day. Anyway, I just started going to meetings. You know, I went the next day I went back, and now I already, you know, I'm trying to pick my seat. I'm feeling a little better, and it was in an old house. And I knew if you sat in back, everybody knows you're new. And if you sit in front, you have to talk to somebody. So I picked a seat in the second row against the wall so that in theory I only have to talk to one person. And I was really proud of myself till it was time to say the Lord's Prayer. And now I got a wall and no hand to hold. And the whole committee in my head launched, what a loser. You can't even say the Lord's Prayer right. I mean, that's all it was going to take for me to go out the door. And nobody likes you. Everybody can see. No, you know, on and on and on. And I just hung my head to pray. And somebody in front of me turned around and took my hand. And I couldn't believe it. You know, I couldn't. And then I'm like crying. Then I'm trying not to cry. Phew. I thought that was your phone for a minute. You're off the hook. It was an interesting ringtone, though. But, you know, just that person taking my hand, they are the reason I went back the next day. And I didn't even know who it was. I never have found out who it was. But stuff like that is 12-step work, too. I think sometimes we get caught up in talking about 12-stepping, and it sounds like if you're not sponsoring 40 people, you're just not, or if you didn't get to go to somebody's house while they were drinking or whatever. And I'll tell you what, remembering a newcomer's name is 12-step work. I just wanted you to know who I was. I didn't even know that's what I wanted, so I sure couldn't ask, you know. I came in like so many of us just saying, help me, you know, help me. I hate you. Why aren't you talking to me? And I started showing up. I went to this big book meeting every day at noon, and I went for many reasons. None of them had anything to do with learning about what was in the big book or getting sober and happy. I had made a commitment to myself that I'd go to a meeting every day, and this was at noon, so I was free after one. That was good. And this particular meeting read a whole chapter every day, and so that chewed up half of the hour, so maybe I wouldn't have to talk. That was good, you know. And I knew from my many trips through treatment, you should read your book every day. So I thought this will count, right? So I don't have to read at home. Because if I read at home, I'm like an hour later on the same page, or else I'm 40 pages in and have no idea what I read. You know, and even in the meeting, I could, because I don't know about you, I was a little scattered when I was new. And so you might be reading, and I'd be reading along to myself, and it would sound like in my head, it's rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed, or I wonder what it's going to cost to get my car out of impound later. I better call that guy. And then I would hear a page turn, and I would rejoin you. And I would, you know, they went around the room reading out loud, so I spent a lot of time, you know, counting around, so I knew which paragraph would be mine. Right, because I got to be sure I know all the words and get the right. And rarely have we seen a person fail. Rarely have we seen a person, you know. How's it going to go, best? And you know, when you do that, you're ready. And then some bozo, two people over, reads two paragraphs and throws the whole thing off. But I have found through staying here that God has a tremendous sense of humor. And what happened to me in that big book meeting, many things happen. One, my day is free at 1. At 4 o'clock, I'd remember I had no life. So I'd just go back for another meeting that night. And yeah, they read the whole chapter, and I started to hear it, you know. And because I started to hear it, it started sinking in. And I knew it was sinking in because I was, I don't know, maybe 3 weeks sober. I started answering phones for my mom at her office because I was basically unemployable. And so I could go work there a couple hours, go to noon meeting, and go back. So I'd come to the noon meeting. I'm on my way back. I stopped in Walgreens to run an errand, and I popped up to see what everybody was talking about. And they're all still there. I just don't go up there very often. But I popped up to see what everybody's talking about after the Big Book meeting. And somebody in my head was saying, that was so cool what Guy said at the meeting. And somebody else said, I know, I didn't even know that was in the book, did you? And somebody else was going, I didn't know that was in the book. And I just remember thinking, oh my God, the voices in my head are getting sober, you know? I mean, it's like, how cool is that, you know? They're up there discussing the meeting without me. This is a good sign. So, and the biggest joke on me was that, you know, what I didn't know is people who go to Big Book meetings on purpose tend to read the book and do what it says. And my laziness had plopped me into the middle of some of the most active people in Cincinnati Alcoholics Anonymous. And they just dragged me into the middle. You know, they had me answering phones at intergroup by the time I was 10 days sober. I mean, they were on committees. And at probably about three weeks sober, somebody said, Beth, you've been around before. Why don't you write an inventory? And I thought, why don't I? I didn't know I could say I wasn't ready. You know, and I wrote an inventory as it's outlined in the book. And that woman who didn't want to take care of her kids either became my sponsor. She heard my fifth step. And my life took off. And I am so grateful that I didn't have somebody telling me, whoa, 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 a step a month, or, you know, some of that stuff that's out there. Because the book I have says, if you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, you are ready to take certain steps. And I was ready. I could no more have gone 2 months or 4 months or 6 months with no inventory and not drank. Because even if I had a good day, when my head got almost to the pillow, somebody up there would go, yeah, but you know, you don't even want your kids. What's wrong with you? When you are staying dry with no solution, a lot of guilt can creep in 24 hours. And I had to unload that stuff and make some room for God. And my life took off. Another thing that happened early on was, I guess I was a week out of detox, so maybe 2 weeks sober. And I was at the Friday night meeting, and they passed a second basket because one of the members of that group had lost his 9-year-old daughter that day to a drunk driver. And, you know, my kids were at my mom's, had been at my mom's for 3 years by the time I got sober. And the next Tuesday, he was in that Big Book meeting. And I couldn't believe he'd even be in a meeting 5 days after he lost his daughter. And he talked about how it happened. And in Cincinnati, if you got a DUI, you had to go do 3 days to make the court happy, and you did it at a place called Drake Hospital. And this two cars were drag racing, hit the car she was in head-on, in front of Drake Hospital on the weekend when those people, well, it was Friday, and the people who were there for their DUI weekend were outside on break when it happened. And so this guy, Charlie, said, maybe if one of them saw it and got sober, it wasn't for nothing. You know, I have to believe some good will come out of this. And when I left that day, I was thinking, God, what if that had been my kids? What would their memory of me have been right before they died? Or what if I had been in that car? What would they be left with? Because my word was worth nothing to them. You know, I was never where I was supposed to be. And it was like just this minute where the trees got greener and the sky got bluer, and I realized that I had a chance to just go call my kids right then and tell them I loved them just because, with no strings attached. You know, I had always wanted a do-over. I always wanted to go back, erase, 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 you know. And that day I realized that for whatever reason I had been given a gift of sobriety, and gift and sobriety were not two words I ever put in the same sentence. So I remember thinking, where did that come from? That I had this gift where I could build a relationship with them from right where I was, you know, life on life's terms, and that I might be a weekend mom for the rest of my life. And if I was, that was okay. I could be a good weekend mom. And that's where the healing started with my children. And my first amends to my children was to stop making promises that I couldn't keep. You know, I made one promise to one kid and kept it. I made one promise to one kid and kept it. And they came to meetings with me. They came to me. My kids did 4 meetings a week from Friday to Sunday. And it wasn't that I wanted to involve them in my recovery. It's that I didn't want to yell at them all weekend. And I knew I would if we didn't keep busy. But what the side effect of that, you know, because my biggest fear when I got here was that I would be unable to love them. I was afraid that alcoholism had just completely killed off that ability in me. And I brought them to meetings, and you guys loved them. And you guys talked to them, because what they had heard from me for years was, I love you, go away. You know? And I brought them here, and you guys taught me how to talk to my kids. You sat down and you talked to them eye to eye so they didn't have to look at everybody like this. And you had them help you get coffee cups. And you knew that they played soccer, and you colored with Sarah. And they became part of, and their gaze came up off the floor, and they began to look the world in the eye, and they became less invisible. And we just, you know, when I was a year sober, we went to a picnic. And I said, if you want to go play, go ahead. And I always told them that, and they never went and played. But that day, Robbie came. All of a sudden, I realized he was tugging on my leg. And he said, Mom, I just wanted to let you know, if you need us, that we're over here playing. Well, what I realized, you know, that grace, that moment of seeing things the way they are, they knew they could let me out of their sight and I would be there when they got back. And it took a year for that to happen, you know. And we just kept showing up. By the time I was 15 months sober, I had my driver's license, a car, and insurance all at the same time. And by Thanksgiving of that second year, now I got about a year and a half sober, and I'm looking at my little 7.5-year-old son. He's got an awful lot of women in his life, you know. I mean, just me and my mom and his sister and a little guy like that. He should have a man in his life. And for his sake, you know, I probably should start looking around. And hey, that is the kind of loving, giving mom I am. Only thinking of him. And 405 Oak Street, the clubhouse up there, did a big Thanksgiving get-together, and they had laid out food at 1. And I went to the noon meeting because that's what I do. And when I came out, I couldn't find Robbie, and somebody said, oh, they're across the street. And there was a schoolyard across the street, and there was my 7.5-year-old son and another little boy and 4 of the guys who were in their 20s over there playing football. And I thought, well, where else should a 7-year-old boy be on Thanksgiving Day except playing football, right? But the thing of it was, that moment of grace again, I realized I did nothing to make that happen except go to the noon meeting. And it hit me that Robbie's needs would be met, as would Sarah's and everybody else's, if I just did AA and stayed out of the way. You know, if I do what I need to do, their needs are met too. One of Chuck's old sponsors used to say that he thinks God gave us AA to just keep us busy and out of his way. You know, it's like, whoa, shiny thing over here, Beth. You know. I had met Chuck by then. We weren't dating yet, but I had met him a couple years earlier. He came to speak at Oak Street, and I'd never seen him before. And so I'm thinking, well, how sober can this guy be if I don't know him, you know? And because I knew everybody there. And he got up and gave this great talk, you know, just great. And I just remember thinking to myself, you know, I want what he has, and I am willing to go to any lengths to get it. But I didn't act on it, and we crossed paths periodically for the next year, but we didn't start to date till a year later. And when we started to date, he dated about like I did at last call, and so we made a decision that we were going to get to know each other and leave our clothes on for a while, and that has worked out well. We just celebrated 19 years of marriage. And yeah. Which we think, you know, I mean, around here, long-term relationships about 4 months. So we figure, you know, dogs get 7 years for every year. We think alcoholics should get 12 because we do things in 12. So we've been married, what, like 232 years or something. But we began to date. We got to know each other. I'll let him tell you the dating story. Sometimes we talk together, we end up, like, stealing each other's stuff. So I'm going to try to leave his talk for him to tell you Thursday. But if he forgets to mention it, I have been sober just a little longer than him. sometimes he leaves that part out. And but we dated for a year and a half and wanted more than ever to be married when we got married. And we're just having a blast. And you know, the kid, he's the only dad the kids really have ever known. And we did get custody of the children after he got his degree, and we were able to move into their neighborhood. First, we moved into the neighborhood. Oh, I guess I should back up a minute. When I was a year sober, I talked with my mom, and we decided that no real good purpose was served for me to take the children back when I had a year of sobriety. I was working for $7 or $8 an hour. I was in a 10th floor efficiency in a crappy part of town. By the time I was a year sober, she had them for 4 years. They were in a blue ribbon school district, safe, clean neighborhood, stable friendships. I was the only disruption in their life. They were doing what they needed to do. So we determined that I would catch up to them rather than pulling them out of everything familiar to come live with me. And I was blessed that I could do that. I know everybody's kids aren't in a safe place and they can't do that, but mine were, and I was able to, and I'm really grateful for that. So Chuck and I bought a house in the neighborhood next to their neighborhood, because they lived in a blue ribbon school district and the house prices were accordingly priced. But we caught up to them, so, you know, we're in the neighborhood next to them, and they're spending a lot of time at our house. And at Christmas, we bought them bicycles the first year and bought ourselves bikes too, because they're little, so we thought, you know, we should probably ride with them. And Of course, up there you buy them in December and you get to ride them in March or April. So the first warm day, we're all out on our bikes. Dad, mom, big brother, little sister, you know, it's kind of running through the suburbs. It was a little surreal. You might have noticed by now I wasn't real suburban. And we're riding, and some guy's already out mowing his grass. They do that a lot out there. And he waved, so we waved. Now, where we had been living, if you had your hand up, you had two hands up. There was a gun somewhere. Our cat, we moved out there, and our cat was freaking out because he was like, he'd sleep on the windowsill at the apartment through sirens and guns and breaking glass, but he got out there with the crickets and almost had a nervous breakdown. So anyway, we're riding through the neighborhood. This guy waves, we wave, and all of a sudden I get a look at where I was, and I thought, oh my God, I used to own my own Harley, and I appear to be riding through the suburbs on a lavender Huffy. How did that happen? You couldn't have told me, guess where you'll be, Beth, you know? But the amazing thing about that minute is right there, right then, there's nowhere else I wanted to be but on that bike with those kids. And that is light years away from not even knowing if I could love them, you know? Another big gift I've gotten here is wanting to be where I am almost all of the time. You know, because I always needed to be somewhere else with somebody else for things to be okay. And I just like being where I am most of the time. And we went on to get a house in their neighborhood. They started 5th and 7th grade walking out the front door like everybody else's kids. And then they became teenagers shortly after that. Whole new set of arguments ensued. Like, you wanted them back. No, you wanted them back. No, you wanted them back. We had some rough years with our son. We really had a time when we didn't know if we'd ever all be able to sit in the same room together again. But, you know, God is God, and we just kept doing what we needed to do. And we sat down with our daughter when things got particularly rough with our son and said, you know, you've grown up with AA God in the house, but this is going to be hard, and you need your own relationship with God because we don't think you can coast on ours anymore. And we want to be there for you, but we need to go to more meetings right now, not less. Because if we don't, it's kind of like on the plane, put your own oxygen mask on first. You know, if we do not maintain ourselves through this, we cannot maintain you. And so we said, Alateen or church, either one, but you need to establish your own relationship with God. And she dove into youth group, and we all got through it. And, you know, 10 years later, our son lives 3 miles away from us. He moved to North Carolina after we did. And, you know, our daughter has been stationed in Fort Hood, Texas, and she decided she doesn't want to be deployed every other year while her daughter's growing up. We have a 4-year-old granddaughter. And so they made the decision that they're moving to North Carolina. And she deployed for Afghanistan at the end of June. And a week and a half ago, I was in Texas helping my son-in-law and granddaughter move to North Carolina. So she went to her first day of pre-K today. We're saving a seat for her, let me tell you why. She started preschool today. Now, we had offered her, we have a cat, so we offered her $10 to feed the cat while we're gone. Big money when you're 4, you know. We said, you have to give your dad $3 for gas, because he's got to drive you over here to do it, and it's only fair. But so Jordan, we talked to Jordan to see how the first day of school was. He said, fine. He goes, but I got to tell you, we went by your house this morning to feed the cat. She would not get out of the car. And I said, what's wrong? And she goes, Daddy, I don't work. I go to school. So I guess Jordan's going to be feeding the cat. So, but, you know, we've got an amazing life, and we've got to do amazing. I mean, you know, if anybody told me I'd be spending a week in Colorado, you know, with 500 of my newest, closest friends, I couldn't have told you. We started playing golf, and we moved to North Carolina and realized Pinehurst was nearby, and the U.S. Open happened to be there that year, so we went down or the next year, I guess, but you have to buy tickets a year early and get in the lottery and all that. And then we got the email, congratulations, you know, you can buy tickets, and we're charging your American Express card $9 million next week. But we went down to Pinehurst, and I know non-golfers think so what, but golfers are like, oh my God, Pinehurst. So we're down there, and we're walking around, and all of a sudden we realize, like, oh my God, like, because we're on the 18th green at Pinehurst number 2, watching the PGA players putt in. And nobody knew, I mean, they just, nobody's moving away from us, you know. And we just were one of the crowd, and we looked at each other and just busted out laughing, like, this was so not on our list, you know. I think when I got sober, all I wanted was, like, I want my driver's license back. I'd really like to stop getting arrested. Maybe someday get married again, preferably to a guy with a job. I mean, that's it. That's all I wanted. And now we're on Pinehurst number 2, and we just looked at each other. It's like, how the hell do you get here from the Dewdrop Inn, you know? And we have been parasailing in the Keys once. We'll never do that again. Never, never, never. You will not see us on the ski lift this week. But we get to do wonderful, amazing things. And it's been brought about by a relationship with God that was established through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? A is my path to God. It is my path to usefulness. If you are here, I hope that you're happy about being here. If you're not, we don't care. Stay anyway. Because the book says our attitude and outlook on life will change, and mine certainly has. And I wish you all a fabulous week. Thank you.
Wow. She took a